the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.
Well, this is Athena Melville here, your host for Education Now, and I thank you very much for listening. Education Now is being brought to you tonight by our members, and tonight I have the extreme pleasure of welcoming Susan Eaton, author of The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial. And Susan Eaton is an award-winning journalist specializing in education. She is the former assistant director of the Project on School Desegregation at Harvard, where she received a doctorate in education policy. Her work has appeared in The Nation, The Hartford Courant, and the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, among others. And with our nation's urban schools growing more segregated every year, Susan Eaton set out to see whether separate can ever really be equal. In The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial, which will be out in paperback in January of 2009, Susan Eaton takes us inside the classroom and the courtroom to reveal the unsettling truths about an education system that leaves literally millions of children behind. And so we welcome you tonight. Susan, are you there?
I am.
Thank you so good evening, and thank you so much for joining us tonight. I know that where you are, it's late. It's about 10.
That's okay.
And so I just so much appreciate it. And I want everyone to know that Susan said to call her Susan so that no one gets upset that we're just too informal.
I wouldn't want to be mistaken for an elitist. You know?
Oh, well, I can't tell you how much that book means to me, The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial. And it's a wonderful, you've written it so well. It's subtle.
Oh, thank you.
It's not, you know, like in your face. It's thorough. From, you know, and in, I mean, it covers really an observation of over 5 years, right?
Yes, exactly.
And that's what's so meaningful about it. And you're not just looking in one classroom about one, and one teacher and one student, which you did very well, focusing on Jeremy from the time he was 8 years old into eighth grade, yes. And Miss Luddy, his teacher. Am I saying that properly?
Mm-hmm, yep.
And but you were not only looking at those two situations in the, but you were also looking at the whole thing, the whole system there in Connecticut, the way that it has evolved since Brown versus Board of Education, and then the is that called Sheaf? Is that how you say it, or the Chef?
Oh, the Chef
yeah,
case, yeah,
the Chef case, and so it's so thorough. And unfortunately, you know, it's the same with Jonathan Cozzal's books, which, you know, I would start reading Jonathan Cozzal, and I would get so depressed I would lose the book, because knowing that if you were really going to talk about what we know in education, we know that the only way to be successful is if the child, each individual child, is at the center. And that each individual child's needs are being met. And we knew how to do this, and this research is old. We know how to do this, and we were doing it before the Reagan years. At least we were doing it here in California, and it was going to spread and grow. But that's when we had a caring attitude in education, and we weren't running it like a business. So I'm not even going to question the veracity of your research, like some of the educational critics that I read in doing research on this have done, where they don't look at what is the priority, which is each individual student here.
Right.
We're not talking business here. And
right.
So on this show, we're just going to assume that that's a given. That best practices is that the child, each individual child, is at the center. And I just, you know, it's so, well, it's disheartening. One of the, could you give our listeners a little, if you can, about the sheaf, the trial?
The chef case?
Yes.
Sure, absolutely. the chef case was actually what first drew me to this subject. It was a case that I had followed since I was a young reporter, actually years and years before I started writing this book. And basically the argument of the civil rights lawyers who brought this case on the behalf of parents in the Hartford Public Schools was quite simple. It was that because the Hartford Public Schools are so deeply segregated by race and by economic class, children are basically forced, really, because of the school district boundary lines that separate municipalities, they're forced to attend segregated, highly unequal schools. And the lawyer said, because the schools are so overwhelmed with the social problems that are related to poverty, the schools, the institutions, in spite of the excellent teachers, oftentimes, and the excellent principals, and Miss Luddy is a case in point in this particular school that I focus on, that the children, the lawyer said, are still unable to receive an equal educational opportunity. And one of the most amazing things about this case was that in a time of conservatism, you know, in the Bush 1 era, we're going down, you know, after Ronald Reagan as well, the Connecticut Supreme Court agreed with the lawyers and ruled in the civil rights lawyers' favor and the parents' favor, saying that the schools were segregated, that this was illegal under the Connecticut Constitution, and that children in the city of Hartford were not receiving an equal educational opportunity. And then what followed was a lot of backpedaling on the part of the state legislature to actually come up with a remedy to this segregation, which really permeated the region schools, just like segregation permeates so many schools, you know, across our nation.
That's so true, and I mean it permeates, and they're sort of like the disappeared when we don't talk about them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if the poor are separated from the middle class, and the dark skinned children are separated from the white skinned children, there's really no other place in society where these different groups, as they've been defined, we could argue with that too, can really come together and begin to break down those stereotypes and begin to learn across lines. And also for children who are disadvantaged, and especially who live in neighborhoods of concentrated disadvantage, hugely disproportionately Black and Latino children, there's little connection to the mainstream society where the vast amount of opportunities actually lie. These kids are cut off not only from, you know, high-achieving peers, but have very little firsthand knowledge of life outside of a neighborhood of concentrated disadvantage. And then they are, as a result, severely handicapped when and if they ever are able to break into that larger society, if they are somehow able to, you know, get to college. The fact of their isolation is something that handicaps them. And we have this kind of story in the United States that anyone can overcome their odds, you know, the odds that they grow up with. Anyone can overcome disadvantage. They just have to want it enough. They just need to try hard enough. And what I think one of the lessons of my book is that it demonstrates, I hope, for readers, the relentlessness of poverty and the way in which it just permeates a social institution, and the way in which these huge structural barriers that have been decades in the making and have their root in racial discrimination make even the most saintly and the most intelligent and the most hardworking, devoted teacher, they make her job extremely difficult to do. And I chose this particular teacher on purpose. I wanted to go to what was ostensibly the best school, and I wanted within that school the best teacher. And I asked a lot of people to find out who that best teacher was, and it was practically unanimous agreement that it was this woman who I focused on, Lois Luddy. And then I asked Lois Luddy, okay, who is your most promising student? And then I focused on that child.
On Jeremy.
Yes, and so this was really a best-case scenario of kind of racially segregated, separate but equal. And what we find are blatant inequalities, the kinds of things that you can measure, but we also find a subtle type of inequality that's less tangible and less quantifiable. I spent time, in addition to spending time in this quite poor neighborhood, one of the poorest zip codes in the country, I also went to a nearby suburban school and spent time there and compared what was happening. And a lot of it was, like I said, was subtle. It was the way in which teachers spoke to kids, the expectations of kids, the vocabulary that children had, their experience with the world beyond their small town, their kind of confidence in talking about things, and the teachers' ability to have a very enriching curriculum that included things like studying the rainforest for several weeks or writing novellas or having people from the community come in and talk about, you know, their hobbies like railroads or literature or what have you. Whereas in the Hartford Public Schools, this was the community that I was writing about, everything was about the test and getting a higher test score and making the children obedient, and a lot of talking to them quite sharply, as if then the whole goal was to get the children to stay in line and to behave and not upset things and to stay quiet.
Yes, you did a great job of drawing the contrast between those two different situations. We're talking here with Susan Eaton, author of The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial, which will be out in paperback in January and Algonquin Press. And we're talking about the constant racism which exists in our public schools. And I wanted to, you know, when you were talking about the contrast between the two schools and the way that the children are treated in Ms. Luddy's, in Jeremy's situation, and I recall this part where you took your son, Will, who I don't know how old he was at the time, but you took him with you, and his comment, he was so right on.
Yeah.
And how the children see that. They know.
Yep.
They're not, you know, and it was like out of the mouths of babes comes this wisdom that all of these people, you know, in this institution seem to question or like, what, huh?
And right.
That was the beautiful part. That was...
Yeah, and I hesitated putting it in there because I didn't want to... and I'm working on another book now about immigration, and just a few weeks ago, my younger son came up with a nugget of wisdom, and I'm going to have to include that, but
yeah.
That's exactly right. I mean, at the time, Will, who's now in seventh grade, was a kindergartner, and he had just started school in a, you know, very diverse but solidly middle-class school, and his sense was that the way that the children in this school that I focused on, Simpson Waverly Elementary, which was 100% black and Latino, and about two-thirds of the students there were from low-income families, and it was a very poor neighborhood.
Extreme poverty.
Will's sense was that the children were being horribly mistreated. The janitor was screaming at the kids. He was calling one kid an animal. He was screaming at another one, saying he had to go after school. They weren't allowing talking in the cafeteria during the only social time that these children had during the day. And it was an amazing thing for me, because I had even become conditioned to the way that the children were treated. And while I was writing about it and reflecting about it as I was taking notes and writing the book, it did start to become normal to me. Over time, I stopped being horrified by it, and I started to get used to it, and it seemed almost normal. And when I pointed it out to the teacher who was teaching, who is the gentlest soul you could imagine, and she said, "Oh, yes, isn't it terrible the way that the kids are treated?" And I said, "Well, shouldn't we, you know, do something or say something?" She's like, "Oh, you know, no, what are you going to do?" It was the prevailing culture. It was permeated so much that it was difficult to bring it up and to talk about it and to imagine that it might be able to change. So then, through the eyes of my son, who didn't have those feelings, who just reacted on a very emotional level, I was able to, and then eventually Miss Luddy as well, to see it in an entirely different light. And while it wasn't my role as a, you know, observer or writer, I ended up, you know, did speak with the principal about it.
Yes, it was amazing. It was like your son was saying, "Where is justice?"
Yeah. And he was quite appalled that I wasn't doing anything about it.
Yes.
He was very confused about that. He's like, "What? Why are you letting this happen?" And I thought, "Oh my Lord, he's so right, because if I ever walked into his school and saw an adult treating a child in that manner,
with,
I mean,
such
first
disrespect,
of all, there'd be hell to pay, you know, not just from me, but from, you know, the entire community of parents whose kids attend that school." And so it just, And so I'm not saying that what was wrong with those parents for not speaking up. Some parents actually did complain, but again, it was this sense of, like, they expected so little.
Yes.
And they felt so powerless.
Yes.
That you didn't stand up to it. It's almost like growing up in a family where there's perpetual abuse. Until you really become grown up and you're able to look at it from the outside, you think it's normal. And those kids did think it was normal. And the ones who stood up to it were the ones who were considered insubordinate and got in trouble.
Yes, of course. It's so sad, because you know that the self-concept of those children is so closely connected to how they will do in school,
right,
how they will approach learning for their whole lives.
Right.
And so for me, you know, it was just it was so great, your son. I was so glad you put it in there. And,
well, thank you.
And, you know, there is this, you know, among the more enlightened people who work, there is this thing about taking your child to work with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that my granddaughter's like, "Oh, well, this week we get to go to work with mom or dad or whatever." And it's always a wonderful thing to do, you know, to bring them into your life. And I was so glad that you were doing it, even in the situation where some people would say, "Oh, well, we don't want to have the kids, you know about this. It would be just too traumatic, so he shouldn't really go with his mom." But I was just so proud of you for taking him, and I was so proud of him. But I feel like all children, really, they know when injustice is present.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
I didn't have any problem bringing him, but, you know, a lot of people said, "Oh, you're bringing him to Hartford?" And
yes.
I thought, you know what, children live there.
Yes.
Like, if you're so concerned about my one son coming for 6 hours of a school day, you know, why don't you have a problem with all of the, you know, hundreds of kids who actually live in the neighborhood?
Right.
And a lot of times I get questions, is the neighborhood that I spend time in, actually, I think a lot of time inner city violence gets overblown, especially among people who live in the middle class, and people are unnecessarily afraid of urban areas. But in this particular case, this actually was a pretty violent neighborhood, and especially in the evenings, it wasn't a safe neighborhood. Homicides and shootings were actually quite common there. But I often get questions from people, like, "Were you scared going in there? Weren't you worried?" And I thought, you know, why are you so worried about me? You know,
What about all these kids?
Right, exactly. I'm not the issue. And first of all, there aren't people, you know, waiting with guns to shoot you. It's not like that. And you want to get rid of those misconceptions. But again, the larger question is, why is my safety worth questioning, or why is it of more value? Why is it even coming up when we don't think at all about folks who live in these neighborhoods and under a lot of circumstances are, some of them are quite committed to living in that neighborhood for a variety of reasons. Some of them want to get out and they can't. They're trapped. And vast majority of the people who feel like they're trapped and want to get out of there are young children who really don't have a choice about where they live. And so I try to move the discussion to that level, and then I think the discussion becomes a lot richer. So,
yes, it does become a lot richer, especially if people just don't want to close their eyes. And unfortunately, we are in such denial. You know, we can see it over there in South Africa. You know, we could see
right.
it. Oh, man, we were upset. But we just can't take a look
right.
at ourselves. And that's why your book is so important. And I just hope that lots of people will read it. Once again, everyone, we're talking with Susan Eaton, author of The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial, which will be out in paperback this January, and I just know that it's an important work, and it will help us all understand. Of course, Jonathan Cazale raves about it as well, which is not surprising. But there was a part here that I wanted to talk about, where you quote Martin Luther King. And it's in the part where called The Beloved Community.
Mm.
Do you mind?
Oh, I love that, yeah.
This is the afterword. The Beloved Community. Since the first Chef trial ended in 1993, scholars across the nation have quickly produced evidence, rather decisively, documenting the harms of segregation and the benefits of policies and programs that connect racially and economically isolated families to the mainstream. And then I'm going to, were John Britton and Wes Horton only now starting to argue Chef versus O'Neill in trial court, they might very well be able to make a sure, simple case. Before considering this research, it's useful to acknowledge that desegregation represents not merely a policy or a set of political choices, but an aspiration, a moral vision of an inclusive, cohesive society. School desegregation, in particular, is not and never was sold by its advocates merely as the most effective treatment for increasing test scores. Evidence, however, does strongly suggest that reducing concentrated poverty, segregation's ever-present attendant, might in fact contribute to higher achievement. There is indeed one crucial truth that often subsumed in the legal battles in the reports of research findings from universities. It is so basic a principle to educators in racially mixed schools and to involved, informed civil rights lawyers that it usually goes unargued. Desegregation and integration aren't synonymous. Desegregation, the condition the Chef lawyers try to bring about, is a precursor, a process sought in part through legal enforcement. Desegregation may be brought forth by laws, but good does not inevitably flow from it. Mere desegregation may, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, create a society where men are physically desegregated and spiritually segregated, where elbows are together and hearts apart. It gives us social togetherness and spiritual apartness, and it can leave racial minorities, King warned, with a stagnant equality of sameness rather than a constructive equality of oneness. And that was a quote. Integration, in the best sense, for exceeding assimilation, is a richer coming together. In an integrated school of the sort Cheryl Klosko's University of Hartford Magnet School and Timothy Nee's Montessori Magnet School aim to be, more than demographics looking good, no student stood unconnected to the whole. teachers imparted to children that each was vital to others. Climbing past desegregation to integration takes more than a court judgment. It takes open hearts, open minds, and open attitudes, qualities the best adults struggle to gain and most five-year-olds have in abundance. Oh, there's more there that I should go on, but I hate to read quotes when I've got you on the air.
Oh, that's okay.
Schools such as UHMS work to carry children toward what Martin Luther King called his own ultimate goal, fostering the beloved community in America, genuine intergroup and interpersonal living, integration. By 2005, UHMS had achieved something rather than improved test scores. Though challenges remain for Kolesecko and her teachers, the chef-inspired UHMS was busy, intentionally, purposefully bridging a racial, economic, an ethnic divide, a century in the making. It wasn't a white school. It wasn't a black school or a Puerto Rican or a Latino school. It was not an urban school. It was not a suburban school. It was finally just a school.
Mm-hmm.
But administrators in America have increasingly been pushed to regard only bottom line results, and certainly a style of accountability that might help prevent educational neglect of the nation's most vulnerable students is a crucial policy. But desegregation success, if it can be measured quantitatively, should be considered over the long term as well, weighing the experience's effect upon adult lives, opportunities, points of view, educational attainment, social mobility. In the decades plus since the first chef trial, it's been confirmed through social science, through scantily publicized, that desegregated schooling correlates strongly with many long-term benefits for racial minority students. Oh.
Yeah.
There is hope, I guess, huh? Do you think there's hope, Susan?
Yes. I mean, I think there is. And I think it's a matter of, at this point, looking for models on the ground that are doing a good job, like the couple ones that I highlight in the book.
Right.
Of bringing kids from various, you know, types of communities and from different racial and ethnic cultural backgrounds together, and schools that are striving to create, to sustain that level of diversity, and also to create models of true integration. And I think there are examples of that, and we're less prone to kind of know about those because, especially in recent years, the focus has been almost exclusively on schools that are able to get their test scores up.
Yes.
And that's, I think, a much easier task than actually creating an institution that is truly a model of the best that the United States can offer, that truly
yes.
teaches kids how to become full members in society, in terms of economics, in terms of politics, in terms of civic engagement, so many things. And I think that schools can be extremely powerful engines. But as they're currently structured now, in which segregation is increasing and the space between the have and have-nots in our society is growing, poverty is actually on the rise in the United States.
Yes, and we're bailing out millions,
yeah.
billionaires, and while in the meantime, you know, the schools don't have enough money.
Yeah, I know. It's always, but when we want something for social problems, there's never enough money. So it,
yes.
it is a little, I mean, I don't want to sound naive, but it is a little confusing, I think,
it
to the to an ordinary person. And it breeds in a tremendous amount of resentment, I'm sure, among parents, for example, in a lot of schools where teachers don't have adequate materials, where their kid doesn't have access to a computer, et cetera. And you think of all of the money that's even if we're not thinking about the bailouts of the various financial institutions, which I confess to not completely understanding. I just don't want to be poor,
right.
like a lot of people. I think that, you know, you could make an argument that even, you know, lacking that, our priorities are rather to put it nicely, confused. We're spending billions on a war with an unclear goal and reason, and we're spending billions and billions of dollars to incarcerate people, oftentimes on technical violations of their parole for nonviolent offenses. And our schools in many areas are strapped. One thing that I do want to make clear is that while this book is about the continuing relevance and harm of racial segregation, particularly against African Americans and certain Latino groups, one of the things I'm not arguing is that no progress, you know, I still believe that you can make a tremendous amount of progress in urban schools that are racially segregated. I think that there's a lot more that can be done. One of the things would be, for example, reducing the amount of time kids spend drilling on tests and actually allowing kids an opportunity to learn how to become members of a democracy and allow them to practice the arts of democracy.
Yes.
Right now, they're so disconnected from society in general, and then on top of that, we're oftentimes not even giving them physical exercise at recess anymore. And the civic education gap, there's a young woman named Mira Levinson who writes about this. She has a book coming out, I believe, in January about the civic education gap and the fact that middle-class schools are so much more likely to, one, just teach basic civics education and also give kids an opportunity to make decisions and to set, you know, and to have reflective discussions about morality and ethics.
Yes, to have choices and dialogue and do critical thinking.
And begin to understand other people's perspectives,
right.
All of that.
I'm telling you, we know how to do it, and we could do it. And, you know, if they lowered the student-faculty ratio, if they really focused on each individual child instead of all the labeling and testing, we could do this thing.
Yeah.
This is a doable job. We knew how to do it. And sometimes I'm a cynic, and I just wonder if because we knew how to do it and we were moving in that direction, we got stonewalled. And my name is Athena Melville. This is Education Now, and we've been talking with Suzanne Eaton, author of The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial. And we're going to take a little very short music break because this song is just about a minute long. And then we're going to come back, and Susan has said it's okay for me to open the lines. And we'll continue with this dialogue, and we'll also let you join us if you'd like to. Okay, Susan?
Okay, great.
Okay, so here comes a little music.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
Well, there you have it. And I hope that wasn't too painful for some of you. Sometimes the truth is painful. But we're here with Susan Eaton, author of The Children in Room E4, and we're talking about if separate can ever really be equal. And in her book, The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial, and we're going to open up the lines so that you can call in and ask questions yourself. So let's go on. Susan, I was curious about, you know, you did so much more than just observing at the schools and talking to the teachers. You were also talking to the politicians and the people who were directly connected and the administrators with the way that the school was managed and run. And their chief concern seemed to be the test scores.
Oh, yes. That was definitely the priority of the higher-ups that I ran into, no question about it. And it was an exclusive focus oftentimes, so much so that, you know, there was talk of little else when the issue of education came up, and it's how schools were judged, it's how the quality of administrators were judged, and it was, you know, and it really did have incredibly, I would say, negative impact on the curriculum that the kids were learning. And it what I felt like it did was that, and what I observed happening was that it created even more distance between the kids who were in more affluent suburban districts and the kids who were in urban schools.
Yes, there's a quote here that relates to that. You say, the poorer the school district, the less parents generally engage with schools.
Right.
Non-engagement isn't fated, and it's not the case in every poor urban school, but it's typical, and it's understandable. Corral
right.
the most disenfranchised, least educated, savvy, least entitled feeling, most stressed out and exhausted members of society into one isolated social institution, and they'll be less likely to oppose whatever's an offer.
Right.
And that was so true, and it's so obvious. I mean, it doesn't take a you don't have to be some kind of a rocket scientist to understand these things. That's
right.
the other. That's why I brought up Will, why I brought up your son. And there was another boy who had been most affected by the first, the trial, you know. And he speaks up and he says, I'm trying to find it, where he talks about, you know, just don't do this again. You know, do how he tells us how to proceed, essentially.
Right. That's Milo. He was one of the plaintiffs in the first trial.
Yes, Milo.
Yeah, and during the course of the trial, of course, which, you know, the case, which is actually not closed, still going on. There's still negotiating going on back and forth. The lawyers have really stayed with this case in an unbelievably dedicated way. But what Milo says is that, you know, he was nine, I think he was 8, 9 around there when the case actually started, and then he grows into a man, of course, during the course of this time, and there's a press conference when they think that they've finally reached a pretty good settlement, and Milo basically says something quite eloquent, quite wise, which is that, You know, I grew up, I, you know, didn't have the experience that, you know, my mom and I were fighting for, but, yeah, don't repeat the cycle. Get kids together as early as possible and let them grow up, because if you start too late, those stereotypes are already built up and you're not going to be able to get past them.
Right.
And we see that all the time. We see that on work sites now. We have people can't talk to each other. And we have another generation of, you know, misunderstandings and prejudice and incredible fear. We see it playing out now with immigration. I mean, it's the same kind of thing that drives us.
Yes, I feel that that Milo, who has at the time of this writing had his own child at that time,
mm-hmm.
And he says, I guess I do, I guess I'd say one thing. If you start too late with integration, there are only going to be problems, because too late, like by high school, that's too late, see? Already you have stereotypes all built up. The only thing I would say is that kids should start with integrated education in elementary school as young as possible.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, wow, I'm so glad that Milo made it, and I hope that his child gets opportunities he didn't get. And I just hope that more and more people will look at this and recognize that it's so important, because this is our future. Our children
right.
are our future. And it's just so sad to waste a generation. And we say that the children... You know, I often get upset sometimes when people talk about pro-life. I feel I'm very pro-life. Look at this life
right.
that we're not pro about.
Right, and that's really the main the principal emotion that I had, and I tried to channel that into writing this book. It wasn't my main emotion was not that I necessarily felt sorry for these kids because, or that I pitied them because they were actually amazing. I mean, the kids were full of energy, full of curiosity. They were happy, at least in the few years that I knew them. They were no different than any other kid, you know, that you would meet. We tend to kind of mythologize the inner city child sometimes. My point was that really my main reaction was, God, they are amazing. They're so beautiful. They're so smart. They're so intelligent. And then in the next beat, the most overwhelming feeling was, what a waste. What a waste.
Right, what a waste. And I think the reason that they responded positively to you, and the same with Miss Ludi, who was very, very wonderful person, I could tell from the book, is that you weren't feeling sorry.
Yeah.
You were empathizing. You weren't giving pity. And that's a totally different... kids can tell when you really care and when you're just, you know, tolerating them. Just like some of the people in their environment were tolerating them and being so disrespectful. That's the one thing, you know, to ask children to be respectful and then not give them respect.
Right.
And of course, the most frustrating thing of all is that we've known this for so long and that there have been so many obstacles thrown in our way and that the media isn't more on top of it.
Right.
That's why I so much wanted to have you on, because I want to do all that I can to make people aware and so that they can do something. I know here in California, we spend more incarcerating someone than we do per pupil in education.
Right, right.
I mean, that's just so, so...
Yes, it is. And I think it's really important to connect those dots between, so that we can look, we can stand back, so we can not just look at the educational problems of our country and say, oh, gee, what a mess, we need to, quote, fix our schools. You know, it's not that the schools in and of themselves they're not the central problem, really. The problem is that the priorities of the country are out of whack, and and that a lot of these institutions are completely overwhelmed and dysfunctional because of the way that things are organized and structured. The way in which, you know, some schools are incredibly overburdened and stressed and other schools aren't. They're left to function quite well and they're funded quite adequately and they have support from the community. Other schools are marginalized just like their population. You know, what happens in the school is a reflection of what's happening in the larger society. And when you talk about something like incarceration, that's so important because we need to be able to stand back, look at the whole society and look at, oh, okay, so part of the reason why these schools aren't, you know, the kids in these schools aren't receiving the resources that they want, that their parents, you know, aren't connected to jobs that provide a living wage, is because we're spending so much money incarcerating people. In some cases, people's fathers, who may have been providers, if they weren't in jail on, you know, these minor technical violations or for having some marijuana or whatever it is. There's no way to, you know, keep nonviolent people integrated in the society and productive. We're just tossing them into prisons, and it's you know, cycling back, and it's going to catch up with us, not just in terms of you know, problems with our state budgets, but just the fact of communities that have been deprived of, you know, huge numbers of contributors, of fathers,
right,
of mothers, of whatever.
Right.
Someone's
trying to get us, Susan. Shall I take the call?
Sure.
Hold on. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
My name is Mike. I live in Albion, California. I've lived here for about 31 years. And I have had to spend some time in recovery recently from surgery, and so I've been listening to a lot. And I'm hearing over and over again the pain in people who cannot seem to get from their society what they thought they always were told they were going to get from their society when they were in school. One of the things you touched on, I mean, I thank the caller very much, Susan. I respect and admire the amount of effort that's gone into this study. And I look forward to reading your book. The thing that has hit home was your comments about respect. I have a daughter in who went through the Mendocino schools, and she's in her second semester at a college called Eckerd on Tampa Bay in St. Petersburg, and she is not being given respect, and she was so confused by this. To the point where, you know, it's we had to advise her, you know, on how to handle social situations that she never suspected existed. In this case, it has to do with what education is. Once again, it's a lot of things that have to do with education, just purely money. And she arrived at school, got a room. The roommate who was promised to her never showed up. For what reason, we don't know. But the school is now trying to get her to pay for the other half of the room for the semester. I know this is sounds really bizarre in our thinking. And so we had to advise her how to be very politic about this. And you know, the thing is, it boils down to you're talking about an educational problem, it's a social problem, and it's really a political problem. And I don't know how to say this in any other way, but I'm a person who has voted third party. I'm 64 years old. I've voted for a third party of one sort or another ever since I started voting, and I voted in all the elections that have ever been thrown my way. And, of course, you know, I've been stymied, but I felt better about it than voting for what I was, what I eventually got, and what we eventually got. So, if you could just speak briefly about how we can make the people who seem—I mean, I'm almost at this point, almost want to vote for a party that I've never voted for before because I'm afraid, absolutely afraid, of the candidates on the other side.
Well, caller, I really appreciate your sharing.
Yeah, can you speak about how we can get our educators to get the message of the problems of education to politicians who rule us?
Well, I think I'm gonna talk to you.
I'm gonna hang up so I can listen, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great. A great question and a really crucial thing to do. Educators' voices, when they're actually heard, can be quite powerful. And I don't know if locally, but I do know that recently it's been very interesting to hear the president of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten. She's a new president, and she's been talking a lot about just the issue that the callers brought up, to have educators speak out and become really spokespeople and talk about what they see going on in the classroom as well. And one of the things that she talks about, and I think it's great and I agree with her, is that we need to think about school reform as things not just for the school, not just for things that are going on in the school, not just related to things like curriculum. We need to really think, especially for children in neighborhoods and communities of concentrated disadvantage, about school reform really being related as well to 24/7 kind of wraparound care. So when we start to think, we need to think in our social policy about if we're so concerned about school achievement, and we say we're concerned about closing, you know, what's called the achievement gap, we need to look at the opportunity gap, which is, you know, whether kids have the same kinds of opportunities in life and to succeed, whether they're able to do the kinds of things outside of school that would enhance their learning, for example. So she talks about the need, and I agree with this, the need to, for example, connect schools more deliberately to health services, to mental health services, to be sure that children have after-school programs that aren't just like babysitting programs, but they actually provide enrichment activities and field trips that might allow kids to get out of their neighborhood, to see the world beyond, to make connections, to begin to feel safe, to practice interacting in that world, and to do the kinds of activities, whether it's music enrichment or whether it's, you know, hiking or whatever, martial arts, the kinds of things that kids in middle-class communities and, for example, the type of community where I'm raising my kids really take for granted. It's those kinds of things, in addition to, you know, ensuring, of course, absolutely, that kids have the math and the reading skills. But when I talk to urban teachers, I mean, one of the things that I hear over and over and over again is that 95 to 99% of, you know, the behavioral problems that disrupt learning in their school is related to untreated mental health issues. It doesn't mean that the kids that are going to inner city schools are crazy or anything like that or need to be locked up or labeled in any way. It's that a vast majority of these kids live in very unstable economic situations increasingly. And so what these teachers are saying is that, you know, my kids need help with all the other stuff that's going on outside of school that inevitably will get brought into the classroom. And I just wanted to go back to another thing that the caller asked about respect. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think I see examples of kids being disrespected and sort of tossed aside and ignored in all kinds of institutions. But I do think, and my experience has been, that it is far more common in schools of high poverty. And I don't think that it is just because schools of high poverty have more trouble hiring competent teachers, while that is true. I think that the stress of working in a high poverty environment with this piling on of social problems, getting very little support, constant stress, constant instability, constant pressure to get up the test scores, starts to wear on people. It starts to wear on the best of people, and they get exhausted. And when they're exhausted and stressed out, they snap. They get depressed. They're not at their best. And it's a cycle that goes over and over and over again. It's not to excuse the behavior, but it's also to look back at the larger structure that created these conditions that then aren't optimal conditions for human beings,
right,
to be at their best.
I agree with you, and I agree with everything you said, and I'm sorry that we have to rush now because we're getting up to the end, but I did want to say that unfortunately what happens a lot when there are emotional problems is that drugs get thrown at the problem instead of that person being able to talk to someone, because once again, it's money, right? I mean, what's the most cost-effective way? Well, we'll just give them drugs. We won't really address the problems. And that's another problem that I see, Susan, when kids are having emotional difficulties in schools. But I just thank you so much. It was a great answer, and we had another caller, but I just didn't want to interrupt because it was so important, the questions that our caller asked and your response. Well, everyone, we've been talking. This is Susan Eaton on the line here. It's on Education Now, and we've been talking about her book, The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial. And I think we've just about told you why separate can never really be equal and why we need schools in America that we can be proud of. And I know that teachers, I know many teachers who are as concerned as we are, Susan, and I just think if we could get more press and about what's going on, and not only in all these communities and the way that they've been really created by real estate agencies, which is a whole other topic. But thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's really great. It was a great experience to be with you.
Oh, it was a real pleasure for me, and I hope that you'll that we'll have you on again sometime.
Oh, I'd love to.
That would be wonderful. Thanks so much for being on, Susan.
Well, thank you. Take care.
And have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was Susan Eaton, the children in room E4, American Education on Trial, and I hope you'll pick it up. It's going to be available in paperback this January, and I think that you will really enjoy it. I want to, if you want to contact Susan, you can get a hold of her through Christina at Algonquin.com, Christina at Algonquin, Algonquin.com, if you want to just say, you know, it's to Susan Eaton. And, of course, my contact information is Hermes, H-E-R-M-E-S, at Pacific.net. And I will, and if you want to get this program, you can download it for free, or any shows you hear on Education Now, you can go to my website, www.pacificsites.com. PACIFICSITES.com/Tilda Hermes, and if that's too much for you, just Google Melville Montessori School and it will come up, and you can get those downloaded for free. Our shows now are going to be appearing on the events calendar at the National American Montessori Headquarters. That's AMSHQ.org. And I thank the American Montessori Society for being so supportive of Education Now, and I thank all of you for your support, and I thank all of you for listening. And here we go. And hello, caller. We just can't take your call. And I'm going to say good night, everyone, and thank you so much for listening.
Are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.